Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Today we're going to be talking about the death of Ramaphosa. We're also going to be talking about political violence, killings of municipal officials, politicians, and also government employees, as well as a declaration by the ANC that the economy is in crisis. So, if anyone was following the news back in 2017 or so, when Cyril Ramaphosa was elected president of the ANC, one will remember how many people were sort of swept up that this was a great triumph of democracy and good sense in the country, that the forces of Jacob Zuma, as expressed through his wife, ex-wife, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, had been defeated inside the ANC's elective conference. I remember when it was announced that Cyril Ramaphosa had won the ANC's internal election fairly narrowly. There was a sort of senior journalist I can't remember who she writes for. I think it's mainly the Daily Maverick. Feral Huffagee tweeted something like, "The ANC's done it again." And there was this sort of all these narratives about this is a new dawn, that there's a new hope for South Africa, that things are going to turn around, there's going to be all sorts of reforms. And all of this was sort of kind of whispered. It was never explicitly laid out by the ANC that they were going to do any of these things. Indeed, much of this, I think, was projection by commentators, by business people, by many in the sort of public debate space. There was this hope, and it came to, I guess, to be known as Ramaphosa, that Ramaphosa would be this great change figure who would change the trajectory of South Africa. Well, over the years, that feeling of goodwill and enthusiasm for Cyril Ramaphosa, I think, has faded. You've had commentators like Adrian Dawson and Peter Bruce, who have been very kind towards the president, kind of slowly shifting their views. And I think the opinion piece by Adrian Dawson, the chief editor of News 24, today really puts the final nail in the coffin of Ramaphosa, a kind of political moment that has now drifted away, as it, you know, it didn't materialize into anything real when Ramaphosa ended up being just much more of the same. So I'm going to read little bits from this piece, this op-ed by Adrian Dawson, because it truly is quite brutal on Ramaphosa. It's titled "Ego Before Jobs: What Ramaphosa Could Have Given Trump." When the chapter on his term in office is finally written, historians will look back at this as one of President Cyril Ramaphosa's weakest moments. This was the moment when Ramaphosa jeopardized at least 100,000 jobs and the livelihoods of hundreds of thousands of people who depended on them because of his pride. Ramaphosa simply couldn't get himself to give even an inch to US President Donald Trump's demands to try and dial back the 30% tariffs that will all but cripple our automotive industry and flatten fruit and wine exports. When those tariffs kick in and on Thursday, and the retrenchment letters are issued in East London, Gqeberha, Stellenbosch and Ceres, ideology will fly out the door and fury will set in. Fury over the lackadaisical way Ramaphosa and his administration have mismanaged this existential crisis in large parts of our economy. Truth be told, we did the bare minimum to try and assuage Trump's crazy pain he has inflicted on most countries in the world. So, Basson then goes on to talk about how one of the reasons that things are so bad is that, you know, we're in no position to have a fight with the Americans because of how many people in the country are unemployed. He talks about how Ramaphosa just couldn't properly condemn the singing of Shoot the Poor. He talks about how there was no desire to even announce a proper interrogation of BEE laws. The Expropriation Act was not, despite Ramaphosa's assurances that, you know, your stuff wouldn't be touched. There was no sort of desire to clarify the law or to amend it so that it was less damaging to property rights. And this piece ends with Ramaphosa could have done all this and kept his integrity intact, but he chose not to. Michael, I think this is an important moment in the shift in the debate in the country. This really, I think, is the sort of the sunset of Ramaphosa's political capital that he once enjoyed an awful lot of and has spent many years misspending.
I think that's a very good characterization. And I did like that phrase that Besson used, that, you know, when the crisis hits, when you hit bang your head against the coalface, ideology flies out of the door. And that's absolutely correct. It is very positive. I agree with you, because it does open this kind of public space for raising sensible questions. And this is essentially what I think the IRR has been doing for many years. On all these core questions, you know, the question of expropriation, the IRR has never said there's no room for expropriation, or every country, sensible country, has a sensible expropriation act. The government has got to be able to sometimes act if there's a natural disaster and there's a house about to collapse, or whatever the case might be. There are circumstances that you have a sensible process where this can happen. But what you do not do is open the door for abuse, most particularly for abuse by state authorities. And we have hundreds of them who, in terms of the Expropriation Act, are empowered in this way to behave as they wish, with far greater latitude than is necessary. And as Besson points out, all that Ramaphosa really had to do was to look at the act that is now passed and say, these are the problem areas we agree. We can fix this. We can remove this uncertainty. We can remove these threats. The expropriation is not going to be used as a state sledgehammer to drive through whatever the worst kind of government would wish to do. That, unfortunately, is the case as we stand. A very good government wouldn't abuse it. A bad government would, and there's absolutely no reason why we'd want that sort of risky law on the statute books. That's something he could do. We would go further than Adrien Besson, but Adrien Besson says, you know, of course, Ramaphosa couldn't just scrap BEE, almost certainly without executive order, without an executive order, a stratagem or convention in South Africa. That certainly he can't, and we're very glad he doesn't have that. So he can't just scrap BEE, but he could at least have opened up the government to critical review. You know, we would go a bit further than that, but let's go with that. Just simply say, we are going to examine BEE, look at all the sensible proposals that have been put forward to replace it. So we're not talking about abandoning the idea of empowerment or abandoning the idea of trying to get over the impact of history. We're talking about doing it better and doing it in a way that really is transformational. That he could have done that, and so on. You know, so it really does demonstrate the scope for sensible discussion about what we can do to make South Africa better. Just put it in very, very plain terms, that's exactly what it is. And I think, you know, a point to make we as the IRR, all commentators, think tanks, civil society, we spend a lot of time dwelling on what's wrong, if only not because we delight in it, but because so much is actually wrong. And that, you know, perhaps unwittingly, we tend to reinforce, or this process tends to reinforce, a sort of reflexive pessimism, maybe even cynicism. And then the risk is that we overlook how dynamic South Africa actually is, and dynamic not necessarily in the sense that things are changing and getting better and so on, but that there is a willingness, there is a scope for people to change their minds, people to move in different directions, to think in terms of new solutions, not stick to the old ones. And to come back to that phrase that Besson uses, ideology flying out of the window, flying out of the door, that's exactly what we want to do. We don't need the ideology. We need to look at very, very practical solutions to our problems. And, you know, perhaps it does take a crisis, as this clearly is, to get us to think this way. So, yes, I do agree with Nicholas. Mm.
No, and exactly against the sort of backdrop of the shifting public debate, the ANC's National Executive Committee said that while we're looking at BEE and how to change it, it's here to stay, and it's non-negotiable, and any attempts to undermine it are just racism. And so it once again underscores the way that Ramaphosa and the ANC as a whole have just not been able to be as dynamic, I think, as the public debate. That, you know, the country is really, I think, moving on in an important way, in the media space, in the political discussion space, in the voting space. And yet the ANC sort of still seems to be using the same playbook it's been using for years, which is not a sign that it's going to be long for this world.
No, exactly. Right. I mean, it did, just as you were saying that, you know, I recalled as a journalist back in the mid-90s, would it have been? I think so, yes. Or at any rate, when the contention in the Western Cape was between the ANC and, or actually it was a bit later really, not the minute, 2006 I think was the period, between the ANC, who was actually at that point just beginning to kind of lose power to the DA. The DA had taken over the city, Helen Zille, with one vote, she became the mayor. And all they could come up with was accusing her of being Godzilla. You know, so I wrote this piece about how here was this desperately old-fashioned party clunking away, churning out this sort of childish propaganda rubbish that had absolutely zilch nil to do with conditions on the ground, the state of the city center, which was then appalling. There were deep worries. Businesses were leaving. Jobs, unemployment, gangsterism, Pagad running wild. And, you know, what Cape Town really wanted, what all the people really wanted, is what is now come to pass. We have a pretty solid administration running the place. The city centre is clean and thriving. Businesses, lots of startups, lots of people on the street. It's accessible to people. It kind of embraces the whole metropole. It's, you know, all that stuff. So it's just I was just immediately reminded that a kind of old-fashioned ideological sort of rejection of things is just completely out of touch with the modern world and what people want.
On that point specifically, it's very interesting to me that there's sort of a similar, there's this bizarre sort of repeat of the history in that Joburg now, you're seeing commentators and people who are not friendly at all towards the DA sort of almost cheering on a potential Zilla candidacy for mayor of Joburg, and you think, well, this is once again, it seems like the same story as the Cape Town one, but sort of pushed forward into the future and in a different city.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
It's a weird echo, but I think it does herald the things are moving. But let's move on to our next story. This is, of course, one of the big problems that have set in over the years, and it's one of the reasons why fixing South Africa's state is going to be quite difficult and why we need to urgently get the police working again. So according to a survey done by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data, or some studies done by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data group, municipal officials in South Africa have been increasingly at risk of being killed in the past couple of years. And mostly this is to do with corruption, either people blowing the whistle on corruption or people being killed in competition for corrupt contracts, which also often happens. South African Municipal Workers Union, SAMWU, usually a sort of not really a critic of government, has said that this needs urgent attention, that it's undermining accountability. Independent analysts and observers have remarked that election violence and murders of political candidates in the lead up to elections often gets a lot of coverage, that this problem is actually much bigger than that, that it also includes a lot of municipal officials outside of election times, and that's usually due to fighting over corruption. We quite recently had the Ekurhuleni chief auditor was murdered. Someone was arrested for it, I think, earlier this week, but he was murdered on the 30th of June. And that was because he was investigating a 2 billion rand electricity scandal that he had uncovered. So this is one of the huge crises, because, of course, you can have whatever kind of policy you want. you can issue whatever directives you want. But if people are afraid for their lives, you're never going to get a sort of functioning system, and corruption is going to continue unabated. And I think this really is the fundamental duty of what our state should be doing. We should be looking at maybe creating a specialized police force to deal with corruption that is outside of SAPS, which unfortunately has had the tendrils of corruption dug into it quite badly. What's your take on this one, Michael?
Yeah, it is extremely worrying. I remember just a few years ago when Gareth Van Onselen was working for us, he produced a number of very incisive reports, and one of them was on political killings. And one of the points he made was that the time is going to come when this is going to seep into, or seep beyond the sort of political contest into the levels of senior officials and senior politicians. And I think it really is a very, very serious indicator. 148 municipal officials. So these are, not people who are contending for political posts. They're not party to the necessarily sort of kind of visceral and very sort of I can't really think of the word aggressive competition that is perhaps typical of political contestation, political voting and campaigning and so on. These are people behind the scenes who are doing their jobs. And as you indicated with one example, typically the kind of people who have found something that's going wrong or has gone wrong, and they're investigating it and are then discovered to be doing so. And some person who clearly has an interest in it then acts and they're killed. So it's a deeply serious thing. It reminds me of why Paul Hoffman of Accountability Now keeps stressing that we can have all the other great stuff, the great things we want in our society, but unless we really confront corruption, none of that is really going to succeed and going to be helpful. Corruption really, really is a very serious thing. And as you said, one wants that independent corruption busting capacity, what the Scorpions used to be or showed the potential of being. Paul Hoffman, again, keeps emphasizing the importance of the DA's proposal, the bill to have a new structure set up independent of the police. This is clearly what we very seriously need, and they needs to be politically endorsed, needs to be given whatever protection it requires to do its job properly. Because this is happening in the background, as you say, Nicholas, I think it's a very important thing that it's not just at election time. This is it's just a constant leitmotif going through the background. Not a good phrase to use for such a horrible thing, but the theme of this grim theme that goes on in the background behind all the corruption deals and the failing municipalities and so on, the people being killed because they're trying to fix it. So very, very serious indeed.
Yeah, no, I mean, for this podcast, I read the news like every single day, just sort of go through all of the media sites and opinion pages and things. And I see over and over again that people, these stories of municipal officials being murdered. Now, sometimes it's not because they were whistleblowers. Sometimes it's because they might have been going to give the contract to a different cadre through some other corrupt scheme. But, that too is also a complete disaster. You can have some corruption, but the moment that corruption begins to be so violent, that the stakes get so high, exactly as Paul says, and I had an interview with him, what was it, end of last year, where we talked about this independent unit. It is just completely corrosive to the functioning of a state. You can't have a sort of modern state in any real way when you have gangsterism at such a high level. And that's exactly why this is one of the priorities for any government that it wants to turn things around in this country, is to start getting rid of the gangsterism, because there's just nothing else possible sort of downstream of that. It's like a dam that just holds back all progress.
Exactly.
Okay, last story, and it's kind of a sort of the capstone of the entire discussion we've had. We've got these tariffs from the US. We've got rising level of violence and gangsterism in the state. It appears that the ANC has finally decided that it needs to stop telling us that the economy is great, or that all of the problems are just temporarily caused by the global conditions. They've announced at their recent National Executive Committee meeting that the economy is in a state of emergency. This appears to be mostly in response to the U.S. tariffs. Quote, this is from the NEC. We also characterize the state of our economy as being in a state of emergency that requires drastic action. Our focus on an inclusive and resilient economy is important as we begin the month of August, Women's Month. The financial and economic inclusion of women is vital to the empowerment of women in our country with a view to achieving gender equality. So even here, the sort of ANC can't like stay focused on one thing. It's always going to like tack on, you know, sort of women's liberation with a stapler to the economic emergency. But yeah, so Michael, it's kind of like someone sort of, you know, it makes me think of O.J. Simpson saying that he was going to find the real killer responsible for the murder of his wife, Nicole Brown. And when it comes to our economy, the ANC is saying, damn, how did it get to this state? You know, we're in the state of emergency. What a disaster. Who's responsible for this? Well, I have some ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm reminded of that funny story about it was said of a British officer, army officer, that he was a good man in a crisis, and his handling of every situation gave him ample opportunity to display this talent. And I think this is tragically the case with the ANC, even when it's saying we are in an economic state of emergency. It fails to perceive that it is central to this condition. And just, you know, it just happened to be a piece that we ran this morning on the Daily Friend, and a news piece about Business Unity South Africa CEO Kulikani Mate commenting on the tariffs issue, and you know, he makes this point that countries like UK, Japan, Pakistan, South Korea, the Philippines, Indonesia, as well as regional blocs like the European Union, have successfully negotiated trade deals with the US that resulted in the reduction of the original 30% tariffs. This demonstrates that there is an opportunity for a successful agreement to be reached. But, he goes on to say, provided the country adopts a coordinated approach and prepares a solid offer based on what we can realistically deliver in response to US expectations. I mean, there he sets out exactly what Ramaphosa and his team needed to be thinking about since April or whenever it was that Donald Trump indicated that this is where we were going. Instead of dithering around and blathering away on ideological questions, just focus on what we need to do, what can we do, how do we do this, like other sensible countries around the world. This is now what you have to deal with. This country is important to us. The economy is... The state of the economy, as Adrian Besson has indicated, is critically impacted by every tiniest nuance of the position we take. Let's really focus on what needs to be done and how we can do it practically. You know, a solid, I like Marty's phrase there, that we needed a solid offer based on a realistic appraisal of what the United States expects. So, yeah, I mean, in the absence of that, there's no surprise that we've got an economic state of emergency.
And just to highlight that point, when a country like Pakistan, which is authoritarian, dysfunctional, violent, poor, barely in economic growth, can be more adept at its foreign policy than South Africa, then you've got a real serious problem. Like this is really showing up how weak our position is. It's not like, it's not like we're comparing us to the EU with their legions of lawyers and trade negotiators and things. This is compared to a dysfunctional semi-military autocracy able to outmaneuver South Africa on the world stage and make us look like a bumbling fool while they are, like a deft ballerina. yeah. Anyway, we hope you found the show interesting. We will, of course, be back tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening, and cheers, everyone. That's a wrap. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.